The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'm tempted to say something like we've saved the best for last.
Of course we did.
But I don't think that would be a bit of an overstatement here, because this too is a very important subject, that of the state secrets privilege, and it's one that's especially topical lately, especially in light also of pending proposed legislation, apropos of what we were discussing just a moment ago on the other panel. And what we have, I think, is a good opportunity through this very well-assembled panel, if I do say so myself, to talk about the state secrets privilege, past, present, and future as well. And I'm going to turn you over to Meredith Fuchs, who is the author of one of the articles that's in your handouts, as is Professor Frost as well. And she's going to introduce our panel members. Their bios are available to you. She's probably not going to waste too much precious time, but just briefly introduce them and then take it from there and then go as long as – I don't think the final bus leaves tonight until about 5:15. So we can go on this panel as long as there is interest in doing so. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dan. Well, we're going to talk today about the state secrets privilege, and we're going to give you a little of where it came from, where it is now, and where it's going. 55 years ago, the Supreme Court first adopted the state secrets privilege in a case called U.S. v. Reynolds. There's recently been a lively debate in the media, in Congress, and in academia about the privilege, because it's being asserted in many of the most controversial cases that you read about today, such as the NSA warrantless wiretapping cases, the extraordinary rendition cases, and Dan alluded to the fact that there's been some articles written about it recently. Professor Frost has written an article. There's also outstanding articles by Lou Fisher and by Robert Chesney that are worth looking at if you're interested in learning a little bit about what some of the discussion issues are. Well, just a few weeks ago, in light of this active and growing debate about the state secrets privilege, Senators Kennedy and Specter introduced S-2533, which seeks to enact new safeguards to prevent overreaching by the government and ensure that the courts are taking a more active role in determining whether the privilege is appropriate. Part of the reason it's so important is that the state secrets privilege has been used to dismiss entire lawsuits. So it's not just trying to block little pieces of evidence, but it basically deprives litigants of an opportunity to be heard in court. There's been a hearing in both the House and in the Senate. There's a House version of the bill that's also been introduced. And today, fortunately for all of us, we have a very distinguished panel to discuss these issues. I'm going to introduce each of the panelists. They're each going to talk for about 8 to 10 minutes. Then they're going to respond to each other and to your questions. Our first speaker is going to be Freddie Lipstein. She's going to talk about the origins and the historic use of the state secrets privilege. She's a former senior counsel from the Department of Justice, Civil Division, appellate staff. She retired in 2003 after 28 years of government service. She's litigated many state secrets cases, including being involved with the infamous Reynolds case, which you'll hear a little bit about today, and also Doe v. Tenet in the Supreme Court, which is a case that concerned the Totten privilege, which is related to the state secrets privilege. Amanda Frost, who's sitting next to her, is an associate professor of law here at American University's Washington College of Law. Prior to joining the AU faculty, she was an attorney at Public Citizen, where she litigated cases on behalf of plaintiffs seeking access to government information. She's going to talk about the post-9/11 use of the state secrets privilege. And then at the far end is Matt Miner. Matt's going to talk about the prospects for reform of the privilege and the future of the privilege. He is Senate Judiciary Committee's chief minority counsel for crime, terrorism, and oversight. During his time with the committee, he's handled Senator Specter's hearings and legislation relating to detainees, interrogation, state secrets, and habeas corpus. Prior to that, he was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Middle District of Alabama. So with those very brief introductions, I'm going to turn it over to Freddie to talk about where this privilege came from.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay, everyone? The state secrets privilege is as old as the Republic, but it has its modern roots in the United States against Reynolds, as Meredith just said. This is a government privilege, It is uniquely a government privilege and must be asserted by the head of an agency, and that head of the agency must personally consider the matter over which he or she asserts the privilege. The privilege can be asserted by the government even when it is not a party to litigation, and often is in, for example, contract disputes between defense contractors, where the government is not a party but the contractors are suing each other. It is still a common law evidentiary privilege, although it is constitutionally based on the president's Article II powers. So as an evidentiary privilege, it stands, I think the quote is, stands at the head of the list of privileges. And because it is an evidentiary, a constitutionally grounded privilege, even though there is judicial review of the assertion of the privilege, the courts have given it, given the declarations of the head of agency, what we call the utmost deference under the standard of review. And basically, the court needs to be assured that there's a reasonable possibility that disclosure of the information would damage the national security or disclose military or state secrets. And that's the standard of review. So if the government demonstrates a reasonable possibility of harm, the court must accept the privilege and historically has accepted the privilege. It's a narrow privilege. It's asserted over military secrets, intelligence sources and methods, diplomatic information that would interfere with diplomatic relations or foreign relations. It has also been asserted over cases which we call mosaic cases, where little bits and pieces of information that may be public put together with the information over which the privilege is asserted would reveal something more important and more dangerous to the national security. There are times where the government can neither admit nor deny an allegation in a complaint without disclosing classified information, or if it admits certain kinds of allegations and then suddenly denies them or asserts a privilege over them, it's tantamount to telling you that that information is the secret. So that's called a Glomar case, and the privilege is asserted in that kind of case as well. The effect of a successful assertion of privilege is simply to remove the evidence from a case. Simply. Well, what is the effect of removing evidence from a case? Let me distinguish here between civil cases and criminal cases, because Congress has taken care of criminal cases by passage of the Classified Information Procedures Act. So in a criminal case where a defendant would threaten to disclose classified information in defense against the prosecution, Congress has developed a procedure, or the Supreme Court basically has developed rules of procedures for how to handle the classified information that might be at issue in a criminal case. But ultimately, even in a criminal case, if the government cannot or will not disclose the information, it must dismiss the prosecution. It's very different in a civil case, and Reynolds, the court in Reynolds said that what happened in Reynolds was the district court made an adverse finding against the government when it asserted the privilege. It basically said there was government negligence because the government refused to claim privilege over the information at issue in the case, which was an accident investigation report of a B-29 crash. And the Third Circuit upheld that adverse finding. When it went to the Supreme Court, the court said it's not a term, a waiver of sovereign immunity, to find adversely against the government when it asserts the privilege. So you basically, in a civil case, when the government asserts the privilege, there can be no adverse inference drawn from that privilege. So the balance in a civil case has already been struck in favor of the government's protecting its secrets. So what can happen is, if the plaintiff cannot make out a prima facie case without the classified information, then the case would be dismissed. If the defendant is harmed by the loss of the information, then summary judgment against the plaintiff would be proper. There are kinds of cases where the very heart of the case is the state secret, and in those cases, dismissal would be appropriate as well. And let me distinguish right now that Meredith made the reference to the Totten or Doe against Tenet, which reaffirmed an 1875 decision by the court in Totten against United States. Totten and its recent reaffirmation go to a very narrow class of cases where the very premise of the case is the secret. And the example is, are those cases themselves where the plaintiffs allege that they were spies for the United States. And of course, the government cannot admit or deny that the plaintiffs were spies without revealing a lot of other classified information. And so in those cases where the very pleading tells you that the inevitably a secret would be disclosed, dismissal is appropriate at the outset of the case without conducting discovery, and the privilege is never asserted in that kind of a case. And there was an attempt in Doe against Tenet to wrap the old Totten procedure into state secrets privilege, and the court resisted that in the Doe against Tenet in the Supreme Court. So the Totten cases stand by themselves. They don't really extend very far. So in most of these cases, you're going to see an assertion of privilege. When I was litigating these cases, because the head of agency was required to examine the privileged information personally and sign the declaration personally, the privilege was not that frequently asserted in the beginning. In the first 35 to 40 years after Reynolds, it was fairly infrequent, but it became more and more the case in the late 90s and the turn of the century, running up to 9/11. There were a lot of assertions of privilege, and I can say this now, being out of government. I'll say two things. One, as an officer of the court and representing the declarant and the government, I always satisfied myself. You could say I second-guessed my agencies. I don't think so, but I was always satisfied that the assertion of the privilege was legitimate. I also would, toward the end, got a little bit nervous about the frequency with which the privilege was being raised and expressed my fear that courts would start looking askance at the government when it started to assert the privilege more and more frequently. I don't think it's happened that the courts have gotten into second-guessing the government as much as I thought they would, but I do think that it is happening in some of these categorical cases, which I think Amanda is going to talk about. And so I will stop here, and she can pick right up where I'm leaving off.
Thanks. As Freddie said, I'm focusing in my comments on use of the privilege since 9/11. And obviously, that coincides with the Bush administration. And so I think it's worth saying, before I launch into a discussion of the post-9/11 assertions of the privilege, it's worth repeating what Freddie said, which is that really, each decade following Reynolds, the privilege was asserted more and more frequently by whichever administration. So from 1961 through 1970, the privilege was asserted two times. From 1971 to 1980, it was asserted 14 times. 81 to 90, it was asserted 23 times. 1991 through 2000, 26 times. And then 2000 through 2006, it's been asserted 20 times. So you can see that each decade, we see more and more assertions of the privilege. I counted, based on reported cases using, I should credit him, Bobby Chesney, a law professor at Wake Forest, numbers. And people vary a little bit on how they count assertions of the privilege, but everyone would agree it's being asserted more and more frequently, and certainly before the current administration took office, we could see that trend. But obviously, post-9/11, we became a nation at war. And the administration has taken the position in a number of cases challenging its conduct in the war on terror. It has taken the position that the state secrets privilege, as well as this Totten privilege, require immediate dismissal of all categories of cases challenging its conduct prior to discovery. And there's two categories of cases that we can see pending in the courts today that have arisen since 9/11, in which the state secrets privilege has been asserted in this blanket across the board way. One category of cases, as Meredith mentioned, is the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program. Under that program, and this has been discussed by the administration, the NSA would wiretap, without obtaining a warrant, conversations between U.S. citizens and people located in the U.S. and people abroad if one of those parties was believed to be a terrorist or have connections with terrorists. And that was a program for which, once the New York Times reported on its existence, the administration did come forward, acknowledge the program, and discuss some aspects of it. Another category of litigation are cases challenging the administration's practice of extraordinary rendition. Extraordinary rendition is the term for when the government arranges for somebody to be seized and transported to a country in which there is no guarantee that that country will not torture the person. Now, there's debate about how the extraordinary rendition program has operated, and I think the administration would contest the claim that people had been transported to countries where torture was permitted. But that's the claim made by the plaintiffs in cases. So there have been a significant amount of litigation challenging both practices, and I'll just discuss those cases very briefly. So, for example, in a case called Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation versus Bush, we have an organization that is on a terrorist watch list. It's a Muslim charity that is claimed to have ties to terrorist organizations and to be funding Al-Qaeda under the guise of raising money for charity. That organization sued the administration, claiming that it was being its activities were being monitored under this NSA warrantless wiretap program. Its basis for this assertion was, one, the fact that it was on a watch list and would seem to fall within the parameters of the NSA's acknowledged warrantless wiretapping program. But second, it actually had received a document that had been disclosed by mistake to it that said, essentially, it was under surveillance under the NSA warrantless wiretapping program. So the administration responds, as it has in all of these cases, challenging the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program, with the argument that that the very subject matter of the litigation is of a type that is a state secret and the case must be dismissed, and alternatively, that any documents that the plaintiffs would need to prove their standing and prove the merits of their case are state secrets and therefore the case needs to be dismissed. That argument was affirmed in the Ninth Circuit recently. But the Ninth Circuit did remand with some issues about whether FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, might preempt that argument and remanded for further determination on that issue. So it didn't. I guess the case is still pending. Other cases raising this issue have come up before the Sixth Circuit, before the Northern District of Illinois, and the Northern District of California, all raising the same issues. There has been at least one case, a case called Hepting versus AT&T, where the court said there was enough information publicly available about the NSA warrantless wiretapping program and enough of an acknowledgement by the administration that it had occurred, this wiretapping, that the case could go forward and that there may be individual documents that would be withheld, but there's no need to dismiss the entire case. And then very briefly, I'll mention the extraordinary rendition litigation. Two major cases there. One is a case by Khalid El-Masri, an individual who was picked up in Macedonia. He was eventually taken to Afghanistan. He claimed the CIA was involved in questioning him. He was tortured. And he eventually was released about 5 months later, left on a hilltop in Albania. And it appears from the evidence we have that he had been questioned and picked up by mistake. He sued seeking damages for the treatment he received. His case was rejected by the Fourth Circuit, and the Supreme Court denied certiorari. And then another case, again claiming that there was needing compensation for extraordinary rendition, is a case by a man named Meir Arar, who was held at Kennedy Airport for 10 days, then sent to Syria, where he was kept in prison for many months and tortured. He lost his case in the Eastern District of New York, but he did receive $10.5 million from the Canadian government, which is now worth more than $10.5 million in U.S. dollars. And neither one of these individuals has gotten an acknowledgement from the Bush administration that they were picked up by mistake, although that does seem to be the implication. And obviously they have not been successful in their lawsuits. So just to sum up, this administration has asserted the privilege more than past administrations, although, frankly, I think the numbers are less important than the way it's been asserted, which is to seek immediate dismissal of entire categories of cases challenging the constitutionality of government programs in the war on terror.
When I was asked to come and present at this panel, I was described as the ghost of Christmas future witness, and which sounded fine until I thought about the various adaptations of Dickens' story and what the ghost of Christmas future looks like. You have the ghost of Christmas past, which is a story of remembrance, and then you have the ghost of Christmas present, which is a story of realization, and then you have the story of regret. I'll try to be a little bit more upbeat than that. I'm here pretty much to talk about what's happening in Congress and specifically in the Senate. I work for Senator Spector on the Judiciary Committee, and we have a bill with Senator Kennedy, and I also would be remiss if I didn't add Senator Leahy, also an original sponsor on the bill, that seeks to standardize the procedure for asserting, evaluating, and protecting the state secrets privilege while also requiring some level of review. As you've heard, there's been quite a bit of controversy about the assertions of privilege, whether the privilege is being asserted in the proper cases, and then there's also a debate about whether courts are doing their jobs to look at what the executive is asserting and make a full determination as to whether it's in good faith or bad faith. And the Reynolds case is oftentimes cited as a case where it may have been asserted in bad faith or at least without full disclosure of what was behind the claim. Without getting into whether in any of these cases state secrets privilege is being correctly or incorrectly asserted, we took a look at where should we go in defining the privilege and how courts should look at it. Should we create a substantive standard, or should this just be a procedural set of standards that are just going to standardize everything through the cases? And that the latter was the decision, and the reason why is if you get into the substantive standards, and you really do get into quite a debate as to how much deference should be given to the executive, et cetera, whereas if you create procedural safeguards modeled on other procedures, for instance, SEPA, you can come up with procedures to make sure that the courts do look at the evidence and that the assertions by the executive are uniform. We started by looking at the case law, and I say we. I want to give credit to a couple of staffers who did a lot of work on this. Dave Posen and Hannibal Kimmerer. Dave Posen, who works with Senator Kennedy, did a heck of a lot of work on this, and Hannibal Kimmerer as well, who works with me. And in looking at this, you start with the Reynolds case. And in Reynolds, although people will sometimes criticize Reynolds and will criticize how that case was handled by the executive and even by the court, there's a lot in Reynolds that has guided where the courts have gone ever since. And starting from the premise where the court itself must determine whether the circumstances are appropriate for the claim of privilege and yet do so without forcing a disclosure of the very thing the privilege is designed to protect. That's in the Reynolds case. That's pretty much where we started from. It's important to make sure that the court takes a look at whether the privilege is being asserted properly, but do so without exposing the privilege or the state secret itself. The cases that have come after it have said you need to look at things in terms of a three-step procedure, Al-Masri and others. First of all, make sure the assertion is correct. You look for an affidavit from the head of the agency who's personally reviewed the materials. You second look to see if the claim of state secrets is legitimate. And third, you sort of have a where do we go from here determination by the court. Once the state secret's asserted, what do we do? It's in those last two points where it's really unclear as to what the court should do and can do. And that's where the bill tries to be helpful. The bill starts out by defining what a state secret is and tries to track the case law by saying it's a matter that is reasonably likely to cause significant harm to the national defense or foreign relations of the United States if disclosed. The bill requires a court to look at all of the evidence that is subject to the claim of state secrets. That then goes into how the matter is asserted. The bill has two different procedural devices to guide the executive in how the state secret privilege should be asserted. One as to discovery and as to evidence, the other as to litigation. For instance, if a claim is at issue and you have two civil litigants, the executive should intervene, the executive should file an affidavit, and the matter should proceed from there. And then in terms of how the assertion should be made, it should be made allegation by allegation if it's a complaint against the government, or claim by claim if you're talking about a claim that could bring in a state secret in a matter between two civil litigants. There are some procedural safeguards that we felt needed to be put into place to make sure that courts could look at all of the evidence. First of all, the Classified Information Procedure Act creates a lot of safeguards in terms of how courts should handle the evidence, but you still have the question of what do you do with the counsel? A lot of the counsel that are going to be in these cases, especially if you have two civil litigants, I don't know, ACLU versus AT&T, you want to make sure that the litigants are able to participate in any state secrets hearing. The bill allows for, well, it doesn't allow for, it requires that any litigants who participate in a hearing relating to a state secrets claim, that they have to have clearances. And the question then comes, well, what if a particular lawyer cannot get a clearance? The bill creates a mechanism by which a court can appoint a guardian ad litem who has a sufficient clearance to come in and stand in the shoes of the litigant who is not present, not allowed to be present because their attorney may not be cleared, and still make the arguments. The proceedings are in camera, shall be in camera, may be ex parte. And an important tie-in that goes to the where do we go from here? If the court finds that the state secret privilege was asserted correctly as to evidence or as to a claim, the court looks to whether a non-privileged substitute can be generated and directs the government to provide one. If the government does not, then adverse inferences are drawn where the facts at issue are not being provided by the government in the substitute, and the court has to make that determination. So that's what the bill looks like. There's a House companion bill that was introduced by Congressman Jerry Nadler, and it's also bipartisan. It takes a somewhat different approach. Rather than having the hearings be mandatorily in camera, it's in the discretion of the judge that they may be in camera. The House bill allows for cleared counsel, but doesn't require it. The presumption is that the court should not require cleared counsel unless it's necessary. And similarly, the House bill appears to put a negative inference on even the assertion of state secrets privilege, favoring transparency. So it's a very different approach than the Senate bill, but they're both at the stage where they're being considered in committee. We've had hearings. It'll be marked up in committee in the coming weeks. There are some things in the bill, I think, that will be subject to amendments in terms of what I've described. Everything's open until you go through and amendments are offered. Some of the points that I think will be raised, one point is, although the bill allows for adverse inferences to be drawn if the government refuses to provide a non-privileged substitute for evidence, that doesn't necessarily work so well if you have two civil litigants. Let's say you have ACLU versus AT&T. Against which party are you going to draw the adverse inference if the government refuses to provide a classified summary? That's something that will probably have to be worked out in committee. Similarly, there's the deference question. At present, courts provide utmost deference. This bill doesn't engage in that. If the bill did, I imagine you would have much more debate as to whether state secrets privilege should be asserted in this case or that case, and you might have a little bit more in the way of controversy. Really what we wanted to do was drill down into uniform procedures that courts should use to evaluate state secrets privilege, and then where do they go from there once they determine that state secrets privilege is in fact validly asserted, allowing for the non-privileged substitutes. There's one amendment that's going to be interesting, and it is going to come up. It deals with the question of what happens if a court, in evaluating the claims of state secrets in camera, finds evidence of wrongdoing. What does the court do? This hasn't been voted on. This will be an amendment that will probably be offered. And the proposal is that the court shall make a report to the committees of jurisdiction to make a determination and just provide oversight over this matter. And so let's say in one of the rendition cases, if there's evidence that there was cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of someone by a military official that violates the Detainee Treatment Act, then the report will be made to the Committee of Jurisdiction. The Committee of Jurisdiction can make a determination as to what to do, perhaps akin to what the Canadian government did in a private relief bill. So those are some of the various points that could come up in committee in terms of amendments.
Great. Thank you, everyone. I'm going to give our panelists an opportunity to respond to each other, but if there's some of you who have questions as well, feel free to get up to the mics when you're ready, and we'll recognize you after they've had a chance to respond a bit. Fred, I noticed you were scribbling down a couple of things while Matt was talking. Maybe you want to respond to some of the proposals in the new bill.
I actually just read that bill pretty quickly, and the bill as it stands concerns me because I don't think it's as thorough as the CEPA procedures in terms of forcing a relevance finding first before forcing the government's hand, although maybe I'm wrong about that. And I'm very concerned about the adverse inferences because the government in a civil action is forced into court almost against its will, shall we say. It is not the prosecutor as it is in a criminal case, and to draw adverse inferences when it's trying to protect a legitimate secret does not quite seem fair. On the other hand, I understand that depriving a litigant of a forum isn't fair either, but I do have some concerns about drawing adverse inferences. I've litigated cases where counsel has been cleared, and even with cleared counsel, it's hard when you know you almost don't trust counsel even if they're cleared, and so the government counsel have always been a little bit wary about speaking freely. I've actually had an argument in a sealed courtroom, and I was reluctant to go very far with my argument, and I drew the line because I knew the counsel was not cleared at all levels. So it's very difficult to proceed with the case once you know that you have legitimate secret information involved.
Listening to Matt describe the bill made me sort of think about what the problem is here, and I thought it was worth just articulating it for those who might be a little less familiar with the issue. I mean, courts deal with questions about evidentiary privilege all the time, and when it comes to deciding whether the attorney-client privilege applies or the priest-penitent privilege or the doctor-patient privilege, I think courts feel very comfortable doing that. And they can get the facts they need from the parties who obviously have an interest. But they have the ability to look at those facts and decide, well, there was an attorney-client relationship, or this would constitute something protected by the work product doctrine, or they would be able to weigh those facts. They're familiar enough with the situation that's before them. I think the state secrets privilege and the reason crafting a good bill is so hard, and I think it's a great start, and I very much hope it becomes a law, but part of the reason it's so hard is because courts are very bad, I think, at figuring out whether something's a state secret. They're very nervous about doing that. And in the FOIA context, there's an exemption for national security information that might be problematic and disclose to the public national secrets, similar military secrets. And courts, even though they have been specifically told by Congress in legislation that they're supposed to review de novo an executive determination about whether something constitutes a military secret, for example, courts are very deferential. And it's because I think it is so very hard for them to make this decision in the first instance. And so I think the bill goes a long way to improving the situation by giving counsel, by trying to add adversariness into the process so that somebody is up there with the government explaining why material isn't a secret. But nonetheless, I think it's a very hard task, and I think courts reasonably take the position that they'd rather err on the side of not compensating an individual for constitutional wrongdoing versus disclosing information that could jeopardize the nation.
There's also another consideration in the literature that's out there regarding the state secrets privilege and how it's asserted and how courts evaluate it. And I don't know if this is from Bobby Chesney's article or where it's from, but there's a statistic that says that in the 89 cases that have been litigated over state secrets privilege since Reynolds, 16 of those cases, the courts declined to look at the evidence that was at issue. And there's another 16 cases where it's not clear if the courts look. So you have 32 cases. If you have a procedural framework that says, courts, you got to look at this, here are safeguards. Even in the bill, it has a directive to the Chief Justice to say, you're allowed to create additional procedures, to create additional safeguards for cleared personnel in courthouses, to make sure that the safeguards are there, because it's essential that you protect the state secret, but you should not punt the issue just because the issue is a very difficult one. And in terms of creating procedures in the bill, the real effort here is to try to make sure that everything that is a state secret stays a state secret through the process of evaluating the claim. But where it's possible to create a non-privileged substitute, or where perhaps the state secret privilege is asserted in an overly broad manner, there was reference to the attorney-client privilege, priest-penitent, those privileges are asserted all the time by litigants in good faith in a way that is overly broad, in a way that they may not apply, where there may have been waiver, who knows. State secrets privilege is a privilege of a different nature, but still deals with evidence and can be asserted in an overly broad fashion. Having some level of court review with safeguards is the intent behind the bill, and hopefully the safeguards are adequate, and I know that that's Freddie's biggest concern.
One other comment I wanted to make about the bill is just to emphasize the fact that it provides that in that situation in which a court decides, despite all the efforts to allow this litigation to go forward in some form, it's just not possible. And if it went forward, it would disclose state secrets. The court then has the option, the opportunity to alert Congress to that fact and committees. And it can have the parties and the government report. The bill will require the government to report on how frequently it's asserting the privilege, and also those cases in which a court felt forced to dismiss a case because of the privilege. And I think that's important because one of the goals here is not just to compensate individuals, that's important, but also to provide a mechanism for checking the executive branch. And if a court feels that it's incapable of doing so, I think it's great to bring Congress in, which has a committee structure that allows it to engage in some executive oversight. And so I applaud that portion of the bill as well.
There's another provision I neglected to mention, which is there's an automatic right of interlocutory appeal. So any litigant in the matter can appeal automatically. And I think that with the safeguards of the bill and everything being maintained as privilege, and I think that's an important safeguard because you won't have an errant district court decision one way or the other not be subject to an interlocutory review by the Court of Appeals.
It sounds to me like you are actually going to, if the bill were to become law, it would put courts to a lot of work that they're not doing right now, particularly by reviewing all the evidence that would be in the case, which is typically not how a court functions in a civil matter. I'm curious what the panelists' view is on whether there has been overreaching. I mean, why are we going to make courts do so much more? Is it just the Reynolds case? And if so, maybe Mandy could explain a bit why Reynolds makes people be concerned. But what is it that makes us feel this is necessary?
Well, I think in terms of the response to the workload of the court, I don't think that the bill would make courts have to review every scrap of evidence in a case. I mean, certainly it's easier for courts to dismiss pre-discovery a case than to engage in the review required by the bill. But I actually think that courts, at least I've seen courts do it in the FOIA context, and I don't think it needs to be overly burdensome, especially if they review through the sampling method that's in the House bill. And courts have used that method in FOIA cases. What that means is basically if the government says, these 10,000 pages of documents contain state secrets, and therefore we can't turn them over, the court won't respond, I need to read every piece of that, page of that. The court will say, give me pages 1, 17, 25, 54, 10,000. I will look over those pages and see whether each and every page contains something that you claim is a state secret. And that limits the workload for the court and also is a pretty good test. If those pages all come back as containing information that goes to the heart of the state secrets privilege, great, then the court will uphold the privilege. If they don't, the court won't require all 10,000 pages to be disclosed, but then that will create some extra work for the court. I guess I respond to that by just saying maybe these cases will be a bit more burdensome now, but frankly, I think that's the cost of that is offset by the benefit of ensuring that the government is kept within constitutional restrictions.
There is a provision in the bill to try to alleviate some of this work, even though keep in mind that the review is of the evidence that is subject to the claim of state secrets, which can be a lot of evidence or it could be a much more narrow category. And in the procedures, the government is required to make an assertion that's more particularizes the evidence. But where the help is that the court can appoint a special master with an adequate clearance to assist the court. And I think that where you're talking about 10,000 pages of review where a court has a busy docket, a special master will be used, and that's something that's used elsewhere. But it's something that in this context it seems particularly appropriate.
I was just going to quickly add, I think the bill's attempt to bring adversariness back into the process also will help the court. It's easier for the court to make a decision when it's hearing both sides of the argument, and that's one thing the bill tries to set up.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the special master provision. Earlier today, I don't think any of you were there at the lunch when Judge Lamberth talked to the group, but someone raised the question about using special masters, and Judge Lamberth said that he thought the special master technique was a good technique in FOIA cases with large documents, but the problem is who's going to pay for it. And I wonder whether any thought has been put into how would a special master actually get into a case? I mean, aside from the judge wanting a special master, would the judge have authority to require the parties to pay for it, or does it make more sense to do what some commentators have suggested, have a sort of specialized court that court's paid for by government funds to do these kinds of things?
In terms of the specialized court, and I'll deal with that question, there is a reluctance among a lot of members and of the committee to commit anything to a specialized court. There's just a fear that if you step outside of regular courts and you have judges, even if they're Article III judges who are classified as being part of a special, let's say, state secrets review court or something like that, that you're putting another veil up. And the best thing is just to use an Article III judge and subject to the procedures of CEPA, make this evaluation. I think that the special master is a compromise that allows for that level of specialized review, allows a court to bring someone in. And in terms of the budgeting, that is a good question. I think that if you have a lot of these special masters appointed, you're going to run into the administrative office of the courts coming to Congress and saying, well, we need a greater budget for the appointment of special masters, or you're going to have litigants who are going to be bearing this burden. And I think that's a legitimate question. It's one that I don't know that you can have Congress act on until we see how it plays out more in practice, what the costs are, the relative burdens are, and then I think the Congress can come and act. Budging it in advance would be kind of difficult.
Why don't you?
Yeah, I've heard two or three times in this discussion the idea that this bill will bring an adversary element back into this process. But the reality is, and it happens in FOI cases, it has happened for many years, that the government walks in knowing what's in the documents and can make a real argument. The advocate for access doesn't know what's in the documents, doesn't even know whether the information they need is in the documents. So they have two hurdles to overcome. One is purely speculative because they really don't know what's in the document. And the other is making a really cogent argument about why it's necessary to have it and why it's not harmful to disclose it. So I see this kind of adversary access as being largely a sham because it doesn't allow the side seeking the access really to make an argument that would help the court.
Well, I think what you just described is true today, but the bill, I think, goes a long way to solving that problem because it talks about getting attorneys for the plaintiff, for example, the kind of security clearance and access that would allow them to be on the same footing as the government when they're arguing about the disclosure of the material. They would get to see the material. They would get to see the government's classified affidavits. Or if that's simply impossible for the attorney to get that kind of clearance, the guardian ad litem could serve that role.
I think one problem with clearing the attorneys is the fiduciary relationship between the attorney and the client. How do you erect the Chinese wall once the attorney is given access to the information? How do you prevent them from sharing it with their client? That's always been a problem in clearing counsel.
Well, of course, in some of these cases, the attorney and the client are almost one.
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyway.
Well, let me just comment on that. I think under SEPA, that question is dealt with all the time. I assume under SEPA that counsel cannot discuss with his or her client the classified information the counsel's been given access to with this clearance. And the same is true, certainly, in the military commission procedures that are currently in effect or being discussed with in pending legislation. I've got a couple of questions. One, I think I have one question for each of the panelists, if there's time. First, Mr. Miner gets the easy question, which is, I've been sort of following this stuff on the legislation, but has the administration taken a position yet? I'm not aware of it.
I was really worried when you said I'm going to get the easy one and I wouldn't be able to answer it. The administration has not taken a formal position on the bill. I would expect that as it is right now that they would not support it, that they would seek amendments, and I will probably see, as we do with many bills, a views letter that will come out closer to the markup of the bill in committee that will criticize the bill in one way or the other and point out the flaws that will support certain amendments that the administration will want.
But you think that they'll try to amend the bill rather than just opposing it entirely?
Well, I think it'll probably be, and I'm
or
predicting
it may be hard
without
to tell
being
the
a
difference.
Member of that branch of government, but oftentimes you see this with a views letter where there's opposition to the bill, and it's general opposition. Opposition that'll cite separation of powers concerns, national security concerns, and then there'll be particular gripes with the bill.
Yeah.
And those were some of the things I was citing. There will be amendments that'll come from both sides, folks who are vested in the litigation that's ongoing and the government as well. I would imagine that the fact that the bill does not engage on the deference standard, one concern I've heard raised is the bill deals with or defines state secrets as something that is reasonably likely to cause significant harm to the national defense. The word significant, is that necessary? There are going to be a lot of questions of that nature that will come up from the administration, and if it's backed up with anything that is helpful, it'll be considered in committee. If it comes in at the last minute, and that's the problem with a lot of views letters, then it won't. But I do think folks look for that views letter because oftentimes you're getting it from subject matter experts who've been litigating this for a while, and they can be very helpful.
The follow-up question on that, I think this is very important and promising legislation that maybe eventually will get enacted in some form. Do you think there's any chance that it'll get passed in this Congress?
I'm saying there's a chance. That's the only thing I'm going to say. I'm not going to say at what level.
Okay. Ms. Lipstein, my question for you is, because I think you're being careful not to to express some skepticism about aspects of the legislation, but don't you? I wonder whether you could comment on one post 9/11 question, which is, it strikes me, I think the reason for all this concern about the state secrets doctrine, to some extent it's extraordinary rendition cases, but I think it's mainly the NSA litigation, because there you have a major program that affects thousands of American citizens or people in the United States, and where there are serious constitutional questions raised by the program in terms of its impact on Fourth Amendment and First Amendment rights. This case is so different from the Reynolds case in terms of the impact of dismissing the litigation because of the state secrets doctrine. I wonder if you have any thoughts about whether we need to find a way to deal with that kind of litigation in terms of the state secrets doctrine differently from the way we deal with an ordinary tort or contract dispute that raises state secret issues.
Well, actually, some of the earlier cases that that raised the state secrets privilege, Hayden, Halkin against Helms in Salisbury,
that's true.
Involved wiretapping issues, but they were individual cases where the government asserted the privilege. It wasn't a whole class of cases. And I'm not sure, I share the concern now, I can say that now that I'm out. I mean, I could say it even as a member of the government. I share the concern that the government may be overreaching. But I don't think the solution is judicial. I think because the administration here has admitted the existence of the program, I think the solution needs to be probably executive oversight with congressional oversight. I mean, I just don't think these are conducive to a judicial resolution. But I want to go back to one thing you said about the criminal situation. The reason SEPA was developed was because it wasn't counsel who had access to the information. It was the defendant who threatened gray mail, and so that's why counsel didn't even know the information. It's a different situation than the civil context.
Yeah. My question for you, Amanda, is I didn't realize that this legislation contained provisions. I take the provisions require courts to report certain information to Congress.
I'm sure Matt knows it better than I. It may be that the executive is required to report how many times it's asserting the privilege each year. And then I believe there's a provision in it, and correct me if I'm wrong, saying that in a case where a court feels it's required to dismiss, there would be some requirement following thereon where the executive would be required to go to Congress
executive.
Correct?
Well, no, that's a that's a contemplated amendment akin to the other amendment that is likely to come up, which relates to the wrongdoing that might be found in behind the classified proceeding. There is a second component to reporting. One deals with the numbers. How many times are you asserting state secrets privilege? The second aspect is just an annual report that'll go for 3 years, and then as required on
An executive branch report.
Executive to Congress, to the committees of jurisdiction on the operation and effectiveness of the procedures under the bill. And within that, some of this other information will likely be described, because I imagine it would be a public report with a classified appendix.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to keep the oversight that Freddie mentioned in the picture. I mean, Congress does have a very important role here, but the question is do you wind up having private litigation stopped with an eye towards the executive and the legislative branch be the ones to address these issues, and maybe that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Okay, no, I won't ask my question then. I thought from what one of you had said that there might be some requirements in this bill for courts to report information to congressional committees, which would be quite unusual.
That is the amendment that I described.
Yeah.
But it's an amendment. It's not even Senator Spector's amendment, but it's one that is likely to come up. And the question is what do you do with a court that does in the review determine that there was some level of wrongdoing, something is a state secret. I gave the example just, natural example.
It tortured somebody, yeah.
Do you tell the court it's a state secret, you don't do anything, or do you require the court to report? Do you make it permissive? But do you have a mechanism for that reporting? That will come up in committee. The question is separation of powers concerns. Are you requiring the court to become almost like a prosecutor in an investigative body in and of itself? Those questions will be debated in committee by people who sit a row ahead of me. But that is one of the issues that will come up.
Well, I wonder whether Professor Frost has any comments on the separation of powers issues involved in requiring a court to report misconduct that it discovers in a case to a congressional oversight committee.
Well, yes, and first let me say, I don't know if this inspired the proposed or potential amendment, but the executive itself, in its motions to dismiss on state secret grounds in cases like the NSA warrantless wiretapping cases and the extraordinary rendition cases, the executive itself said these are not issues for courts, but rather for the political branches. So, you know, I don't think they actually wanted to be overseen by Congress necessarily, but I think it was sort of interesting. The implication of their argument is oversight is appropriate by Congress, just not the courts. And, in fact, the district court in Al-Masri said, as the court was agreeing with the government the case had to be dismissed, these are very worrisome charges here that this person claims they were taken by U.S. officials and tortured, sent to a country where they were tortured. And the political branches should deal with this. If he's been wronged, Congress should get involved. I don't see the separation of powers problem as being all that clear. I certainly don't think it's all that clear cut. I mean, courts are required by Congress to do things like report on their caseload.
Yes.
And issue other reports. They're not being required. They can certainly they testify before Congress. They can be called to discuss judicial business before Congress. And you know, Congress passes statutes that affect where courts sit and you know, the various things like when courts meet. So there's plenty of interaction at that level. And I don't, you know, think that there's some sense of the legislative branch taking over the courts or making the courts do their job by saying, just report to us what happened.
Yeah,
but on the
I
other hand, it might be easier just to have the executive do the reporting
yeah.
if we're concerned.
Yeah. No, I think the what's unusual about this is requiring a court to report on facts of an individual case to a congressional
That makes it more, I would
that
agree
makes
that
makes it a little more
closer to the line.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I will. I mean, the discussion of that issue made me think about how in the FOIA, actually, there is a provision if courts find there's been arbitrary, capricious withholding or something like that, that they have to make certain findings that then are supposed to be reported to the Office of Special Counsel, which, in fact, has not ever actually really done anything. It's only happened in maybe one case. But it might be something to look to, a way to make that actually work in this instance as opposed. I mean, and then, of course, the courts, they make the findings in their opinion. They're not actually reporting to the justice or to the Office of Special Counsel about that. I know there's one other question, but I just want to raise an issue because I think that it's we have the unique opportunity to have someone who's litigated part of the Reynolds case, despite it taking place 53 years ago, sitting here on the panel. We didn't give much of an explanation of what happened in the Reynolds case, but it was essentially an airplane crash, a military airplane that crashed, and several civilians were on the airplane and were killed in the accident. Their family sued the government for damages, and Freddie talked a little bit about what happened with the evidence in that case. Well, many years after the case was resolved, I mean, really only maybe 5 or 6 years ago, the daughter of one of the civilians who was killed, she did some research on the internet, just kind of curious. She always wondered what was that secret project her father was working on. And when she did the research, she found that the military had released the accident report that was at issue in the Reynolds case. And I actually, in my car downstairs, have the accident report. It's about this big, and it's a bunch of different documents. It's now released without any redactions. She went back to the law firm that had originally helped her mother, and they went back to the Supreme Court, and they said the government lied. We have the accident report, and in fact, there's nothing secret in it. The closest thing to secret was a reference to a military project. And they tried to get the Supreme Court to revisit the issue. It went back down to the Third Circuit and to the District Court, and that's when Freddie was involved. And I said to her when we were getting ready for this panel, what was secret in that? There was nothing. I read that report. It's this big, and I went through it, as have many people, including Amanda, I think, at this point. What's secret, and why was it justified for the government to move to have the case dismissed?
You think I'm going to tell you a secret now? What happened in the case, and I only handled the part where the government opposed the writ of quorum nobis in the Supreme Court, but I did a fair amount of research. What was going on in the Reynolds, the what was going on was that the military, the Air Force, was trying to develop a pilotless missile out of the B-29 bomber. And the assertion of privilege was very general. It basically said it was protecting the technical aspects of the aircraft and improvements made to it. It turned out that the B-29 was, this particular flight plan was flying at 20,000 feet. It was a bomber. It was, they were trying to develop accuracy without a pilot in dropping bombs. We know this 50 years after the fact. At the end of World War II, when they were doing this, and also as a district court on the, when it, the Supreme Court denied the quorum nobis writ, and the families went back to district court under a Rule 60B motion to reopen the case, the district court went and picked up on some of the historical documents the families had provided and said, in addition to what I've just explained about developing a pilotless missile, the Russians had been collecting B-29s that had been shot down and were deconstructing them, trying to build their own bombers. And one of the major problems with the B-29 was the engines would fail at certain elevations. And each time they were trying to build improvements into the engines so that they could fly higher. And as the district court said, you know, if we told them that we found all these problems with the engines, they would be able to fix it and build a better bomber than we had. So 53 years after the fact, these don't look like secrets. But back after World War II, when we were trying to develop these military fleets, these were legitimate secrets. What happened in the original litigation was that the Secretary of the Air Force and one other, who I can't remember who it was, asserted a general privilege over the technical aspects of the plane and, quote, improvements to it. And it was the improvements in the engine that turned out to be the big secret. But the district court, because it didn't push the issue, maybe should have but didn't, push the issue any further, just made an adverse inference against the government. There was no record, no forcing of any further information. The Third Circuit affirmed. So when the Supreme Court got the case, the only record it had was this very general assertion of privilege. And the court said, the accident report itself is privileged, but you have the possibility of deposing the surviving crew members. The families chose not to do that, but instead to settle the case. So the record is pretty skimpy when you want to get into the nature of the secret at issue. But in terms of whether Reynolds should be unwrapped, I don't think so. It was legitimate at the time, and I think the principles established by the Supreme Court, the general principles about head of agency asserting the privilege and personal consideration, all those principles are legitimate principles for assertion of the privilege today. So, yes, the government might overreach. That was not a case where it did. It just wasn't forced to explain any further. And now, 53 years, we can sit here and second guess lots of things. But if every time the government declassified something that was previously classified, and somebody said, well, I don't see any big deal in that, and they were able to file a suit and claim fraud, the government would be seriously disincentivized, if that's a word, from declassifying anything. So I don't think it's a good route to try to second guess that far away from the events. I knew Dan was planting that.
All right. Well, I'm going to let, if any of our panelists have any closing comments. I mean, I would just say that, you know, this issue of state secrets privilege is one that's, you know, clearly going to be debated a great deal in the next, several months, maybe years. It's not going away. It raises a lot of important issues And I think that all the folks in this panel helped bring out some of those. Are there any closing comments? Okay, great. Well, then thank you for your time.
Just a couple of quick closing comments overall. I'd like to thank all of our speakers and all of our attendees here today. We've had one time or another more than 100 people focusing on these issues, and we've learned a lot, not only from the panel members, but also from the rich dialogue between members of the audience who have a lot of expertise and our panel members. I think one of the things we've learned is that each topic could probably in and of itself warrant a full day of discussion, especially when you learn something such as what we learned right at the end there. Professor Vaughan in his keynote this morning put the FOIA in an historical context in a very scholarly way, and I think you just saw an example of a little bit of history there, or at least something being reflected upon, what, 53 years ago. And it's good that we're able to have Freddie here to speak to that very eloquently and pointedly, despite the controversy about that point. I think one of the themes here, as befits the law school as an academic institution, is that this has been a good education. And that education will continue in a manner consistent with what Lydia Grigsby said this morning about the importance of educating people on FOIA issues through the form of the podcasts that will be available this entire program. They'll be posted on both the university website, the law school's website, and the Collaboration on Government Secrecies website for continued education on this point. We're also going to ask Professor Vaughan if we can make available his terrific keynote presentation this morning in one form or another for further education. And just as a final note, I'll mention that we have a program scheduled on International Right to Know Day, which everyone, of course, knows is on September 28th, just as James Madison's birthday is March 16th. And just as with FOIA Day this month, it falls on a Sunday, so we will be celebrating International Right to Know Day on Monday, September 29th, through the Collaboration on Government Secrecy at Washington College of Law. And I look forward to seeing many of you back again focusing on international transparency in greater depth at that time. But once again, thank you very much to our panelists and everyone on the line.